You are not the sun.
90.3 FM à Montréal.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called the news brought to you live.
Hello, and you are listening to Off the Hour on CKUT, broadcast on 90.3 FM in Montreal and online worldwide at ckut.ca. I'm your host, Jules Bugel, and you're listening to the Local Journalism Initiative Roundup. That's where I share some of the stories I've been working on at the station with the support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Now, today is January 9th, and you know what that means? It's a back to school for tens of thousands of students here in Montreal, as well as across the province, as the FAE has signed an agreement in principle with the government of Quebec. Minister Drainville took today to release his plan to catch students in the province up to speed after some of them have been out of class for roughly a month due to the ongoing strikes in the public sector. We'll have details on that later in the program. We'll also have details on the agreement in principle reached by the 420,000 workers in the Common Front. That's in healthcare, education, and social services. Workers will have just over a month to vote on that deal, and you'll be hearing more of the details on today's show. We've also got news on the tuition front. As most of you know, the Quebec government is raising out-of-province tuition by around $3,000. Well, McGill has an answer to that, a new $3,000 Canada Award for roughly 80% of out-of-province students coming in the next year. I speak to Deputy Provost Fabrice Labeau, he's responsible for student life and learning at McGill, about the details of that award and how McGill is dealing with all the uncertainty that has followed the announcements surrounding Quebec's tuition hikes. But first, we have a short hit of hyper-local news for you and the drivers in your life. Take a listen. Drivers, take note. Starting January 1st, the Plateau-Mont-Royal Borough has changed the price for parking permit stickers. In the past, the borough offered different price points based on the fuel and engine type of a vehicle. Going forward, the borough is using a graduated pay scale based on vehicle weight. The smallest vehicles, clocking in at under 1,250 kilos, will be charged just shy of $250 for permits bought until the end of March. For the biggest cars, with a weight of 1,800 kilos or more, that cost doubles. The system was first introduced in Rosemont-la-Petite-Patrie to incentivize use of smaller and more fuel-efficient vehicles. A Polytechnique Montreal study finds that as the average vehicle size rises, on-street parking is reduced by up to 7,000 spaces in the borough. Borough Mayor Luc Rabouin praised the new system at a council meeting last month.
L'innovation de l'arrondissement Rosemont-Petite-Patrie qui ont mis en place, eux, un système de tarification basé sur le poids des véhicules, on a conclu que c'était eux qui avaient trouvé la bonne méthode. Donc, on change notre méthode, on s'inspire de Rosemont-Petite-Patrie
et on va avoir... Parking stickers last until the end of September, with a discount for those bought from April to July. Starting July 1st, prices go back up, and stickers remain valid until September of 2025. On Sunday, the Common Front gave their first press conference since signing an agreement in principle with the Quebec government. The Common Front is a coalition of unions in the public and parapublic sectors, with the CSN, CSQ, FTQ, and APTS at the helm. It represents almost 500,000 Quebec workers who participated in a series of strikes this fall across healthcare, education, and social services. It's those strikes and the public support of them that have made the difference in obtaining this agreement, APTS President Robert Comeau told reporters on Sunday.
D'entrée de jeu, je veux souligner l'excellente mobilisation de nos 420 000 membres du Front commun, bien sûr, et l'appui indéfectible du public, qui, selon nous, a été un élément déterminant dans cette négociation.
The biggest result of that pressure? 17.4% salary gains over 5 years. Here's CSQ President Éric Gingras with the official announcement.
Au niveau des salaires, effectivement, ça a été dit, 17.4% sur 5 ans. Pas de forfaitaire.
So this is below projected inflation, but almost double the 9% initially offered by the provincial government. But workers will benefit from inflation protections as well. The agreement includes an indexation clause, which would see salaries increase up to an additional 1% per year in years 3 through 5. That'll kick in if the rate of inflation exceeds salary increases. Union leaders also stress the importance of the first year, in which salaries will get a retroactive boost of 6%. Gingras says it's the biggest single-year gain the public sector has seen in over 40 years.
La première année à 6 %. C'est important de le dire, la première année à 6 %, qui est dans le fond 1er avril 2023 de l'année dernière, donc il y aura rétroaction, mais ce 6 %-là est quand même une première depuis une quarantaine d'années au Québec, soit la plus haute augmentation dans le secteur public pour une année à 6 % des 40 dernières années.
Some workers will see even bigger gains. Specialized workers, particularly those in the trades, will see their retention bonus increase from 10 to 15%. Public sector psychologists will see their salary increase by 10%, with harmonization across healthcare and education. And workers across the common front will see gains in insurance contributions, pension plan options, and vacation time for long-term workers. Plus, the unions say that sectoral tables have seen even more advances. Overall, FTQ President Magali Picard says it's a historic deal, and one she has no problem presenting and even recommending to her members.
C'est historique ce qui a été engagé comme somme de la part du gouvernement au niveau sectoriel, compte tenu de tout ce qu'il y a également, tout le travail qui a été fait par nos équipes de négociation au niveau sectoriel et au niveau de la table centrale. Tout ça mis ensemble, ça n'a pas été difficile du tout de présenter cette offre-là.
François Henault, first vice president of the CSN, ended by thanking Quebecers for their support and responding to Premier François Legault, who quipped earlier this fall that there wouldn't be Labatt Blue for everyone in the public sector, insinuating that the Common Front was asking for handouts for its 420,000 workers.
La population était derrière nous durant tout le temps. Vous nous avez fait confiance, donc on tient à vous remercier. Merci les Québécoises et les Québécois qui ont été derrière les travailleuses et travailleurs du service, des services publics. Écoutez, peut-être en terminant, vous vous souvenez, en octobre dernier, le premier ministre Legault disait qu'il n'y aurait pas de la batte bleue pour tout le monde dans les négociations du secteur public. Mais moi, je peux vous dire que les 420 000 travailleuses et travailleurs du secteur public vont avoir une la batte bleue. Merci.
All 420,000 members of the Common Front will have the chance to vote on the agreement at General Assemblies that'll take place from January 15th to February 19th. If more than half of the members approve it, the agreement will come into effect.
There's a lot going on in the world today. See how it affects Montreal's Black and Caribbean community. Read the Community Contact. News, features, opinions, music reviews, cultural events, and so much more. Our voices, our perspectives, our community. Published every 2 weeks, pick it up at your favorite community spot or visit us online at our new and dynamic website, mtlcommunitycontact.com. Easy to navigate and lots to enjoy. Archived issues also on the site and available on the web. That's mtlcommunitycontact.com. Stay in contact.
The government of Quebec made waves last fall when it announced it was roughly doubling out-of-province tuition. This would mostly affect universities McGill, Concordia, and Bishop's in the province. Now, in December, they changed that figure. Instead of a jump to roughly $17,000 per year, out-of-province tuition will be just $12,000, but it's still up by $3,000 from what students currently pay. Now, in response to the provincial tuition hikes, McGill has its own annual answer. It's launched the Canada Award, a $3,000 a year scholarship that will automatically go to applicants for the 2024 to 2025 school year. About 80% of out-of-province undergrads will be eligible, with business and engineering students as the exception. Today, I spoke with Fabrice Labeau, who's deputy provost at McGill of Student Life and Learning. Who's deputy provost of Student Life and Learning at McGill University. We go into detail about the new award, as well as what's happening behind the scenes to ensure that both new and current students are having as smooth a transition as possible to the new reality, where tuition hikes have already forced the university to completely freeze hiring. Here's our conversation. All right. So I'll just start by diving right in. How did the Canada Award come about? Can you tell me anything about its creation?
So we were faced with measures from the government that would basically make the studying at McGill for students from other provinces in Canada very difficult and really prices out of the market by putting the tuition fees at $12,000 per year for these students in many programs that's basically double what they would have to pay at University of Toronto and UBC. And so that's why we came up with this idea of the Canada Award, was to try and offset some of the barrier that was raised by these new government measures.
Yeah, I know it applies to 80% of incoming undergrads for the 2024 to 25 year. Can you tell me a little bit about how you decided on that 80% and whether it's just for this next year as a kind of bridge, or if it's something that ideally the university would like to have in some form going forward?
So the notion of 80% really comes from the makeup of our student body, and in particular students who come from the other provinces in Canada. The Canada Award itself applies to these disciplines like arts, science, etc., or education, where the price differential is really big between the $12,000 that our government has just set and the kind of prices our students would be facing at U of T, UBC, et cetera. So these are really for these particular disciplines. Now, it so happens that these disciplines make up 80% of the student cohort we see from the rest of Canada, typically at McGill. It's been pretty stable over the years. That's why we're saying that this should really apply on average to 80% of our students coming from other provinces.
Yeah, and just on that other point, going to apply for this new cohort, it'll be renewable for them throughout their degree. Is that something that you would like to see going forward if the tuition hikes remain in place? Or is it, something that is just a kind of a bridge measure while the university is getting all of this sorted out?
Well, right now, as you say, we're trying to get everything sorted out, so it's hard to preview what the next few years are going to be like. We're really focusing for now on trying to get our students in for the fall 2024 session. So we've announced this for the fall 2024 cohort. We'll see what the next years look like. And it's very hard to give you a final answer with a shifting landscape like with the one we're seeing now.
Of course. As somebody in the McGill community, we've all been receiving these emails that are talking about really dire impacts financially and on enrollment of the tuition hikes proposed by the Quebec government. What can you tell me about, changes that we might see at McGill starting next year, and what you and other folks are doing behind the scenes to minimize impacts on students?
Well, so you have seen our announcement in terms of the potential financial impacts of the measures that have been taken by the Quebec government. These are really it's large numbers in terms of the potential loss in for our budgeting. We're talking about between $42 and $94 million in the steady state. So it's not negligible. What we're doing right now is doing all we can to first minimize the impact of these new measures. And I think one of the very visible measures is the Canada Award, where we said, well, we don't want to lose students from the rest of Canada because they're part of who we are at McGill. And so we're trying to actually make sure students can come to McGill if they're interested in McGill to try and minimize the impact of the loss of these students. So that's one of the very visible things we're doing. In terms of the of facing that big uncertainty in terms of how much money would be, how much financial impact it would be on McGill's budget, we've also started a hiring freeze, which is a very strict hiring freeze right now, to try and minimize the amount of spending, the additional spending we would make on the on our salary side, because a very vast portion of the expenses on the operating budget of McGill is really salaries of our people. So we're trying to mitigate the impact of these measures the best we can. There's a huge bracket of potential loss that we have talked about between 42 and 94 million. And what we're really trying to do is to do all we can to be towards the lower end of that bracket.
Yeah, I know that, you know, the response that I've seen, at least to the award, has been overwhelmingly positive, but there are some people who have expressed concern about funding such a big award while the university does have a hiring freeze in place. How would you respond to those concerns in particular?
So I have to agree that the response we've received regarding the Canada Awards has been really heartwarming. We've got a lot of support from the from people at McGill, from the alumni community. Everybody seems to be in favor of this particular measure. I think at the end of the day, going back to what I was saying earlier, the creation of the Canada Award, it's really a step for us to get towards a place where the financial loss, the financial impact to McGill, is toward the lower end of that bracket of potential losses we're talking about. So we're really, if you're looking at the impact of the Canada Awards, it does two things. One of them is to make sure that the prospective students from the rest of Canada, from the other provinces, feel that they're welcome at McGill. We want them to come to McGill. The other impact of these awards is it's basically an investment to make sure that we minimize the as much as we can the financial impact of these measures.
Yeah, and you know, you said that over the you've seen this really positive reception as well. I'm a McGill alum, and I know within a few days, I got an alumni email saying, "Hey, we have this award. Would you like to contribute?" Is that sort of funding stream something that you guys are looking into to make this more sustainable down the road, or I guess, you know, where is that funding coming from versus funding for things like salaries? Is that a different pool? Or yeah.
So as of today, it's basically the same pool we're looking at. It is the operating funds of the university. That's the funding that may be affected by the government measures to the tune of the $42 to $94 million that I was talking about. And so as of today, we are determined to fund this from the operating fund, with the idea of, again, getting closer to 42 than the than 94. So that in itself it would be a positive step. At the same time, after announcing the Canada Awards, we've seen very, very heartwarming reactions from McGill alumni in particular, who wanted to step up and help the Canadian students from outside Quebec access the McGill education. So there's been a lot of interest for alumni to contribute towards the Canada Awards, and that's why we started to open this opportunity, because people were asking us, how can I contribute? So, of course, it would be any money that is collected this way from our alumni, any contributions would be welcome towards that. But we're not counting on that to be able to finance the awards.
Yeah, and
we're hoping for it.
Of course, yeah. So a big thing about the tuition hikes was, you know, the university was afraid of losing many, many out-of-province students, really impacting certain programs, the School of Music, for example. What have you seen in response to this award? It's been just under a month since it was announced. Are you seeing any change in enrollment, maybe not enrollment, in application numbers? You know, I know you've extended some deadlines, so I believe international students have a bit longer to apply, though they're not the ones who are eligible for this award. You know, are you seeing the impact already in terms of who might become the entering class of 2024?
I think it's very hard to answer that question now because the one of the issues we're facing is that the several government announcements have created a lot of confusion in the minds of prospective students. And you've talked about the fact that we've extended a deadline for international students because also from their perspective, they're confused. They don't understand what the details are, what's happening, whether or not they're affected by tuition changes. And so we're facing now a very used recruitment season, so it's hard to give you a sense as to what the incoming cohort is going to look like in September. What we're working on is trying to make sure that everybody who wants to come to McGill, who is interested in coming to McGill, realizes that they're welcome at McGill and that we're trying hard to get them here. So at this point in time, of course, we're at the application stage, as you said. We've extended some deadlines. This is where we're hoping to see more and more people apply. But also, as we get closer to September, we want to make sure that people who applied and to whom we make an offer to come to McGill realize they should come to McGill. So that portion there is also going to be a portion in time where it's going to be important for us to be continuing our efforts to bring people to McGill. So the outcome of all this, I'm afraid we'll only see as we come to September, once we see who actually shows up in the to McGill. But all our efforts are exactly where you're describing they should be in terms of making sure that we recruit people, especially in areas where there was a lot of danger of losing a lot of our students from the rest of Canada, including our programs in music.
Yeah, and, you know, it was announced, there's been a lot of changes as the province has tweaked the proposed tuition hikes. As you mentioned, you know, what we saw at the beginning of the fall was very different from the final announcement in December. So I understand that there's confusion for students as well as, I'm sure, a lot of quick movement behind the scenes. But before I let you go, I just want to talk about the other aspect of the December announcement, which was a French language requirement starting with the 2025 cohort. 80% of Anglophone students will have to reach level 5 French by graduation, or the university will have funding clawed back. And I know that that's a ways away, right? But is there anything at all you can say about what McGill has in the works, what conversations are going on in order so that the university is able to meet that requirement?
So I think it's important to first stress what you mentioned, which is that this is not applicable to the 2024 cohort of students. So as we are in the full recruitment season for fall 2024, it's important for prospective students and their parents to realize that there is no French requirement for the cohort entering McGill in the fall of 2024. Regarding that particular requirement of 80% of our out-of-province, the students who are not from Quebec reaching a certain level of English, I mean, we've said it very clearly that it's not a realistic goal. So the details of what that means, of how this measure would be put in place, we're still waiting to hear a bit from the government. There's been an announcement that starting this month, we should be hearing a bit more about the details. But at a very high level, it's simply not feasible. And so that's basically where we are stuck with respect to this particular measure, is that I don't see how we could make plans to try and achieve something that is simply impossible to achieve.
All right. Well, you know, as we've seen in the fall, there's some back and forth, there's some movement, nothing is set in stone. And I know on the student side, there's a student strike planned for later this month. So from the community as well, there's continuing pushback against these requirements. But Fabrice Labeau, I know that you have to run. So thank you so much for joining me and walking me through all the changes and what McGill's doing.
Thank you for having me.
Open the door. Seek New World. In here, Security 90.3 FM from Montreal.
You're listening to CKUT, broadcast on 90.3 FM in Montreal and online worldwide at ckut.ca. I'm Jules Bugel. Today was back to school for most students in Montreal after a semester of strike actions kept kids out of classes. Schools with the FAE were closed for about a month last fall, affecting roughly 40% of Quebec students. The other 60% were out of class during 9 days of strikes from the Common Front. Now that both unions have signed an agreement in principle, the provincial government has released its plan to help students catch up. Education Minister Bernard Drainville announced $300 million in new funding for in-school tutoring, community organizations, and summer school courses. Here he is speaking to reporters on Tuesday.
Today, I think we are sending a very strong message that we are taking every means possible to allow our students to overcome the difficulties created by the strikes and try to bring as many of these students as possible to success. Education is a sacred value in Quebec society, and we need to do everything we can to help the students to catch up.
The bulk of the funding, some $223 million, will go toward after-hours support. To make that happen, the government is calling on current, trainee, and retiree teachers to step up to the plate and provide tutoring to the students who need it most. Those students will be assessed at the school level. Drainville says government funding will be allocated to schools based on need as well, so expect FAE schools to get the most resources.
So for 60%, 60% of our students, it should be, in spite of the days of strike, there are ways to basically make it almost a normal year. Yeah? The problem, obviously, is with the students that suffered a month of strikes. And for those students, we're taking these measures to bring them to par as much as possible with the rest of the students in Quebec.
Spring break won't be canceled this year, but there is the option for schools to open during that time in support of student learning. The minister says whether that happens or not depends on the local level. The same goes for PD days.
Taking the compulsory road would have been difficult for several reasons. The first reason being that it does not belong to me. I do not have the power to convert spring break into a week of teaching. That belongs to the local collective agreements. They need to be negotiated with the unions at the local level. So even though I wouldn't have had the power to do so. I would have had to ask the local school boards to negotiate locally with every single local union.
The ministry is also giving $42 million to relevant community organizations and $36.6 million for free summer courses for secondary 4 and 5 students in subjects covered by a ministerial test. The ministry is also changing deadlines for certain educational requirements and postponing ministerial tests. The ones set for early January will be pushed back 1 to 3 weeks, and the ones scheduled for May and June will be delayed by 2 to 7 days. More details will follow on the ministry's website. The weighting of ministerial tests on students' grades will decrease across the board, Drainville says, going from 20 to 10% for elementary and lower secondary students, and down to 20% for upper secondary students. For students in their final 2 years, those tests will focus on priority learning only.
It's going to be the regular curriculum for all of the students in Quebec, whether you're FR or FSE, whether you suffered a month or whether you suffered 9 days of strikes. But at the end, if you are in the secondary 4 or 5, the ministerial exams that you will be tested on will be on essential learnings, the way we did it with the pandemic. To allow for these students that suffered a month of strike not to be overly penalized because of this long strike that they had to live with.
Education stakeholders have expressed their support for the plan,
especially the flexibility it gives teachers and school teams to identify and address the needs of priority students. Minister Drainville, for his part, expressed relief that the strikes are over.
I feel relieved, but I'm holding back because the votes have yet to happen. So we're hoping that the votes will go well, but we're not taking anything for granted, and we're going to be watching with respect the process that is about to happen.
This is Phone Doc.
And this mess stinking.
When we ain't chilling up in the bricks in the chalet, we chilling out here in Montreal.
On CKUT.
Nobody do it better, dog.
90.3 FM.
Gone.
Looking to spice up your life and bring more flavor to your food? Try Mr. Boom, famous jerk dressing and pepper sauce. It's that good.
One of the groups that welcomed Minister Drainville's plan was the Réseau Québécois pour la réussite éducative. It's a network of bodies across Quebec that work towards school perseverance and educational success in the province. Their president, André Maillet-Perriard, joined me for a bilingual interview to share a perspective we don't always hear in the discussion between parents, teachers, and the government of Quebec. Here's our conversation. Thanks so much for joining us today. Can I just get you to introduce yourself?
My name is André Maillet-Perriard. I am president of Réseau Québécois pour la réussite éducative.
All right. Can you tell me more? What exactly is the work that the Réseau Québécois pour la réussite éducative does in terms of supporting education in the province?
On est dans toutes les régions du Québec. On travaille avec plus de 3000 partenaires partout au Québec pour mieux comprendre la situation de la persévérance scolaire et du décrochage scolaire, la réussite de nos jeunes, puis mettre en place des actions de sensibilisation pour valoriser l'école. On documente des situations, on appuie financièrement le déploiement d'initiatives qui vont favoriser la réussite des jeunes. Donc, par exemple, en favorisant une bonne conciliation travail-études, en favorisant les transitions entre les ordres d'enseignement ou encore en soutenant des interventions là, directes auprès des jeunes.
Yeah, so I'm speaking to you because earlier today, Education Minister Bernard Drainville announced his plan to catch students up after, you know, some of them have been out of school now for roughly a month. And what is your response when you saw the plan, which has support for extra tutoring and support, as well as community organizations and summer classes for students?
On accueille très favorablement ce plan-là. On pense que c'était important de mettre en place des ressources pour soutenir le rattrapage scolaire là, de nos jeunes. Bien entendu, ce plan-là prévoit beaucoup d'interventions en classe, mais pour ce qui nous concerne, on est très content que les organismes communautaires et leurs contributions ont été bien reconnues. Puis nous, on va pouvoir vraiment contribuer à mettre en place. On a d'ailleurs été très actifs au cours des dernières années pour contrer la glissade de l'été, là, pour le summer slide, avec des initiatives là pendant l'été. Mais là, on va tenter de faire des actions pendant la relâche scolaire, durant les week-ends, les soirs, l'été prochain, mais aussi d'identifier les jeunes qui peut-être auront décroché ou en grande perte de motivation avec nos partenaires communautaires, mettre en place des interventions psychosociales pour favoriser le retour en classe ou le retour aux études ou le raccrochage scolaire, carrément.
Yeah, I wonder if you can tell me a little bit more about what we typically see as a result of, you know, prolonged time for students out of the class. We had labor strikes, so it was seemingly unavoidable for both sides, unwilling to budge, right? But as a result, we have these students who really are coming back to class, having not been there since November. You know, what kinds of support will they really need to get back, especially after the pandemic where students' learning was affected so much?
Vous avez tout à fait raison. Il y a un effet de cumul pour plusieurs jeunes de situation, là, la pandémie, puis cette interruption scolaire-là. Il faut se rappeler que souvent le décrochage a lieu pendant une interruption. Les jeunes arrêtent d'aller à l'école et ensuite, ils ne recommencent pas à retourner à l'école. Donc, on a une grande inquiétude pour ça. Maintenant, pour les gestes à poser, Il y a des gestes quand même qui peuvent sembler simples, mais qui sont, ma foi, si importants. Il faut garder le contact, s'intéresser à ce qui les anime le plus, discuter avec eux de ce qu'ils aiment à l'école, hein, de retrouver ses amis. C'est une bonne raison de retourner à l'école, donc il n'y a pas de mauvaise raison de retourner à l'école. Les encourager. On a posé la question à des jeunes qui avaient pensé à décrocher ou qui avaient décroché. On leur a demandé qu'est-ce qui avait fait la différence pour eux dans leur parcours, et c'était les encouragements de leurs proches pour un jeune sur trois. Donc, les encourager, c'est quelque chose d'essentiel. Maintenant aussi, on en appelle aux employeurs. C'est le temps maintenant de retourner les jeunes sur les bancs d'école. Certains sont allés travailler, mais investir dans l'avenir de nos jeunes, c'est investir dans leur retour en classe. Et puis, on appelle aussi les employeurs à encourager les jeunes à retourner à l'école.
You know, you're representing organizations that support students across the province. In terms of the back to school, from their side of it, what will that look like? We're hearing from, you know, parents of students, we're hearing from profs, but we don't hear as often from the kind of community supports that you are representing.
En fait, oui. Alors, plusieurs nous ont dit, eux, ils ont plusieurs organismes de la communauté ont étendu leurs heures d'ouverture pendant la grève et ils ont offert des services. Puis une des inquiétudes, c'est d'être en mesure de poursuivre le déploiement de leurs activités jusqu'à la fin de l'année scolaire. Donc, ils ont besoin d'une reconnaissance qu'ils ont été au front pendant toutes les semaines de grève. Et ils ont déployé des activités puis une programmation beaucoup plus importante qu'à l'habitude. Donc, dans le plan de M. Drainville ce matin, il y a des sous pour les organismes communautaires, puis on espère que partie de ces sous-là vont pouvoir aussi aider les organismes communautaires, donc à pouvoir maintenir leurs activités jusqu'à la fin de l'année. Les organismes aussi, ce qu'ils nous disent, c'est, bien entendu, là, ils les voient, là, les jeunes qui sont démotivés, mais tant qu'ils les voient, on est encouragé. Ce qui nous inquiète le plus, c'est ceux qu'on ne voit pas, ceux qui ne fréquentent plus l'école et qui ne fréquentent plus un organisme communautaire. C'est pour eux qu'on a une grande préoccupation, puis on va regarder dans les prochains jours comment on pourrait mettre en place des mécanismes de référencement de ces jeunes-là pour s'assurer qu'on puisse reprendre contact avec eux et maintenir le lien.
Yeah, that was a large part of the minister's announcement, right? That he was sort of leaving it up to local school teams to figure out, you know, who were the most vulnerable students and have them place the priority in terms of tutoring, but as you said, also in terms of community supports on those students. What you're saying basically is that we don't know exactly how that will work yet, but it looks like all the sort of key stakeholders are going to be working together to try and help basically the people who are most vulnerable in terms of falling behind.
Tout à fait. Puis, outre les jeunes qu'on va identifier, là, qui ont des vulnérabilités au retour en classe, et ils sont très importants, nous, la communauté autour des écoles, on veut aussi prendre le temps de regarder what about ceux qui ne sont pas revenus. The kids who doesn't coming back at school. They will need our support.
Yeah, absolutely. On that note, as we look ahead, obviously there's some differences. There's going to be some differences in the rest of the school year, right? Deadlines are changed and requirements are adjusted. As members of the public, you know, what sort of should we be looking for to make sure that the back to school, that transition in the rest of the year are, you know, having the strength and support that, you know, students are needing to succeed?
Bien, en fait, on va mettre une très grande intensité dans les prochaines semaines, mais il faut reconnaître que pour certains jeunes, le soutien intensif dont ils auront besoin sera bien plus grand que jusqu'à la fin de cette année scolaire-ci. Ça va pouvoir, peut-être pour certains d'entre eux aussi, être nécessaire toute l'année scolaire prochaine. Donc, les jeunes n'iront pas tous à la même vitesse, puis c'est nous qui allons devoir s'adapter pour offrir un soutien important, puis probablement avec intensité, au-delà des prochains mois pour certains de nos jeunes.
Yeah, and in that case, I guess it will also sort of have to wait and see the details of agreements that the various education unions have made with the government. As you know, they're teaching conditions are obviously tied to the learning outcomes of students.
On va avoir besoin de temps. Il n'y a rien qui va pouvoir se faire si rapidement que ça. On parle d'humains qui ont aussi une santé mentale, qui ont aussi d'autres préoccupations, puis qui ont leur rythme d'apprentissage.
All right. Well, we will be keeping an eye on that for sure. But thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure.
So as that conversation made clear, it's not just going to be a matter of catching students up to speed for this term and the end of the school year. What education in Quebec needs is a long-term investment in student success. Now, before the winter break, I caught up with some of the striking teachers outside of Premier François Legault's Montreal office, and they shared their thoughts with me about what the strike was all about, as well as what education needs right now in Quebec to overhaul some of the problems we're seeing in the sector. Those problems include a massive teacher shortage that we were facing coming into the fall 2023 term. Now, we don't know the details of the agreements that teachers and school staff have made in principle with the government of Quebec, but what we can do is reflect on some of the problems they've highlighted in the sector. Here's more from that story now. Here's K-5 teacher Sonia Bolazovic.
So it's interesting, we were just having a conversation about good governance, and I feel like the government has a responsibility and they have one job, and it is to make sure that their people and the needs of their people are met. And this is not being done. It's been neglected for such a long time. And so now we're digging in our heels. It has to change.
How are you seeing this in, like, the negotiations that have been ongoing? Would you say that, yeah, how would you characterize the government in terms of their posture towards jobs like yours, professions like yours? Mm-hmm.
Disrespectful. I think that is the number one word. That's how I feel. I feel very disrespectful, disrespected. I feel as a professional, as a woman, as a citizen of Quebec, I feel very disrespected.
Yeah. Can you tell me, like, a little bit more about that? What is it precisely that has made you feel this way towards the government?
I think it's the lack of listening. So, funny anecdotal story, Mr. Drainville came and visited our school last September when he just became education minister. And it was so... And I had the opportunity to actually sit in front of him. We were talking about Bill 21, which is, I mean, it's, I can't even go into the depth of how disrespectful and quote unquote racist it is. I was sitting with colleagues of mine who come from all walks of life, and one of them, visibly brown skin, was telling him right in front of his face, "You understand that you have narrowed that population. If I don't see people teaching that look like me, you have now obliterated that possibility for me," which goes against everything we do in education, right? To open minds. And yet I'm sitting in front of our education minister who is so close-minded. It was kind of one of those, is this actually happening moment for me, really.
So you're a K-5 educator. Obviously, you will know about the comments he made this summer during the teacher shortage where, you know, there weren't enough profs to actually, like, fill classes. Yes. And he kind of said, well, you know, we can put the inexperienced folks in the kindergarten classes where they don't have to do that much. How does that feel as one of the educators he's talking about there?
But, I mean, it's so telling. How telling is that? How little do you know and understand about pedagogy? And that is where this is why we're being so loud. None of the arguments or any of the offers that they're putting on table are pedagogically driven. None of them. It is a political game, and it has nothing to do with our profession at all.
It seems like, I mean, from what I've heard and what I've seen, that the Quebec population is in support of unions like yours, QPAT, the Common Front.
Yeah.
Why do you think there's such a strong, just like population-wide base of approval of what you guys are doing, even though it's like rounds and rounds of strikes this fall, maybe an unlimited general strike in the works? What do you think is happening there?
Because people see it. It is right in front of their faces. I think also COVID exposed a lot of the issues. And I do remember hearing one of my colleagues saying that, you know, our system is being held by duct tape. And now they're not offering us sewing kits to fix it. And to a point where they're not even offering us more duct tape. They're actually ripping it further. So we don't have a choice. We have to. And, you know, my daughter is second year McGill in education. And I just look at her and I say, this has to change. It has to change. And not for, like, my working conditions, I'm going to push through. Okay, I've made it 27 years. I'm not going to give up now. But I watch young colleagues. I'm a mentor teacher in my school, and I work with teachers in their first 5 years, and my heart bleeds for them because what they see coming forward is tragic.
Yeah, tell me more about that. Like, what are some of the things that you think are pushing young people to either not choose the profession, yeah, or they come in, do a few years, and say, like, yeah, I'm already burned out?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's truly, truly the vast needs of our students now. Is drastically changing. Look, the makeup of society is changing. The makeup of the family is changing. The way that families now prioritize schooling is changing. And so we need to kind of move along with it. But in order to do that, we do need to change some of the systems that are in place in our schools. And so the old, you know, let's put 25 kids in a kindergarten classroom and then just push them along, that doesn't work anymore because the needs are so specific to every single 25 of them. So we really need to, you know, add in more professionals to support those teachers.
It wasn't just QPAD out on Wednesday. There was a contingent from the FAE who's been on strike for over 2 weeks now. Here's Ellen Blaha, who's an English teacher at a primary school in the Francophone system, talking about the strike and some of the reasons behind it.
Yeah, so every day at my school, we kind of signed up for a AM shift or PM shift, which is 3 hours in the morning or 3 hours morning and afternoon. We reduced that to 2 hours after many, many days. Actually, it's been warmer, but just it's be a bit tiring, and it's a lot. But the FAE does a lot of days where they're like, okay, we're going to go protest at this government office, or yesterday we had a march on that first day of the strike, or the second day, there was a huge march with 50,000 teachers. So when they have stuff like that to switch it up is kind of nice.
Seeing that march, all the folks who were out in their red toques coming together through the streets of Montreal, it has to feel, you know, like you're part of something bigger. How did you feel seeing all of the teachers coming out yesterday?
Both yesterday and the first march, especially the first one, because it was so huge, it's just kind of like you're so discouraged that, like, you don't get a contract, like, the government doesn't seem to want to negotiate or listen to you. And then, but then you go to a march like that, and it's just, like, so many people, and you feel, like, really great to be part of something, and you feel like there's so many people there with you that really changes it from being, like, to being discouraged to being kind of like, okay, I'm part of something bigger, and it's really motivating.
Yeah, how are you feeling about the community support as well? Because obviously, you know, parents are trying to find ways to look after their kids, but it seems like, from what I've seen and heard, at least people have an understanding of why you guys are on strike, why it's led to this point. What have you been hearing in the community?
From the beginning, I was kind of... That was kind of a question mark for me as to whether the community would be with us. And I think right at the beginning, I heard a statistic that like 70% of the population supported us. And from what I've seen, I haven't looked at it for more statistics, but from everything that I've seen, I think I haven't seen any indication of a decrease in that. I think people are still with us. Right here, we have a group of parents from that were first graders at the school I work at. That's why I'm not picketing in front of my school. I'm here because parents organized a play date avec Lego, and I said, okay, I could come here and do my protesting here, and I get to see the kids who I really miss, so this has been great.
Yeah, there's lots of kids playing in the snow. Before we were chatting, you were over with them. Speaking of Legault, though, I heard that there was a possible offer earlier this week, right, that got rejected. There seems to be a bit of a mismatch between what the government is saying they're offering and then what the FAE is actually hearing. How do you, I guess, view the way that the CAC has approached the, you know, the bargaining table, all of the months of negotiating over salaries, over work conditions, things like that?
Well, from what I've heard, and I'm not an expert on this, but it seems like, you know, we've been without a contract for over a year. It seems like the government, not just this government, but every time they, like, just don't negotiate or do very little for a year until the contract expired, the contract is well past expired, till we're about to go on strike, till we're on strike, and then they start getting serious. And it's always very frustrating, right, that we let it get to that point instead of fixing it. Only the last time I think they fixed it early, and I think that's because it was, like, COVID was happening, and they're like, okay, we're going to deal with this, give them a nice big raise to get the, to avoid a strike because we're in the middle of a pandemic. But it seems like if it's not a big crisis like that, they don't seem to care and put it off till the last minute. And don't seem to be doing anything. They're trying to change some things to get some things what they want, and some of them are a bit legitimate, like changing, like, some of the affectations that I agree with. But we have a huge teacher shortage, and the stuff that they want to do will give them more control, but it's also going to make more people leave the profession, and it's the opposite of what we need, because we need more people to stay in the profession.
What is it about the work conditions that you think, or I guess salary even, that is leading to such a big teacher shortage in Quebec? And is it, like, a result of the pandemic, people just getting burned out, or is it something more structural that you think needs to change in the sector?
It's a good question. It's a lot of things. I think it started before the pandemic. The pandemic, like, exacerbated it. But, you know, yeah, you go somewhere where you don't have a great salary and you are working, especially those first few years of teaching, you're basically working 12-hour days and it's nonstop, and you probably take your first contract at a more difficult school where there's you know, a lot of difficult kids in your class, and you don't get the support, and it's overwhelming, right? And you have to put up with that for many years before you kind of either become used to it or have enough seniority to switch out into a school that better fits you or that's better run. It could be all sorts of things, right? But that's the stories that I'm hearing. I'm in a school that I absolutely love. I have a job that's great. I've been teaching for 20 years, right? So, but the story I'm hearing from teachers who are starting out, and it was like that for me when I was starting out, it's just, like, so overwhelming. And, people leave too soon.
News sucks, we know. So why not join us for a cool show? Exploring the state of Canada's Chris Media landscape this Saturday, January 13th. It's at the St. Jack's Center in downtown Montreal. It's the inaugural edition of the Harbinger Showcase live podcast recording series. Come and hang out with Rob Russo, Harris Marks, and Nashua Khan. It's a media criticism panel combo with special guests from Pelsing Youth Movement, Reach Media, Sierra Club Canada, and more, plus an after party connecting left journalists and activist communities. It's like Canada Land, but anti-Zionist. Hopefully see you there.
Before the ad break, you heard a story from last December, an interview with two teachers who were protesting outside Premier François Legault's office. Before that, you heard more coverage on the back-to-school plan introduced today by Minister Bernard Drainville.
To close out the show, we have an interview with Mark Andrew Hamilton, who's a core coordinator of an exhibition charting 40 years of Quebec's gay archives. We've got the full interview available online at CKUT/LJI, and an excerpt right here for you today. Here's that conversation. Yeah, so the more about the show, it's a new exhibition sharing 40 artifacts from Quebec's gay community, one for each year of the AGQ's existence. You know, gay community, is that specifically the gay community? Is that the larger LGBTQ plus community?
Yeah, it's plus all over the place. There's many different groups that are represented. And we asked, we spoke to 40 different researchers and friends of the archives. So there's a couple of fellow students. Like a really interesting researcher named Devin Gwynn has a piece in the show, as well as Gabrielle Iaconetti. And then we have people like Barbara. We have other people who were firsthand, people that were the sex garage raid and just other people. So there's not one object from each year, but it's just 40 different people that are selecting something. And it kind of gives a broad overview of what's there. And what's surprising for me was that I could have picked 40 things from the collection that I thought were cool, and a lot of those things aren't actually in the show, and there's a lot of things that I've never seen myself. So it's really, really fascinating, actually, what came together and how people view the archives differently.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you can just give me a sense of, like, what kind of pieces are featured in an archive like this. You know, is it a lot of, like, print archives, ephemera of that kind? Is it, you know, are there bigger pieces? Like, I just have no idea what that actually could look like in practice. I guess people will have to come down to the show to see everything, but when you're thinking about some of the things that struck you that people chose for the exhibition, like, what are some of those?
Well, I think the smallest objects we have are things like little buttons or matchbooks, a collection of matchbooks that's on display, and as big as protest banners that were carried through the streets of Montreal in the 90s. There's these huge paintings that kind of open the show that there's certain objects that we don't even know much about, like those paintings, for example, but they are huge pieces that played some role in the queer history of the city. So there's this big range of stuff. And as for what's in the archives, it's everything from clothing to documents to love letters. Like, there's this one collection of love letters that I particularly love, and it's a one-sided love affair that kind of falls apart. And I think these letters were written in the 60s and 70s. And that's, you know, that sort of thing is there. It's just a huge range of things. It's a very living archive, and it's not just the limited to paper.
Yeah. How and why, I guess, did that archive come about all those years ago? You said it's for the 40-year anniversary. What is the story of that, you know, that founding, that creation 40 years ago?
Well, it was founded by a group in Montreal who are still actually, some of them are still active at the gay archives, people like Ross Higgins, who just felt like things needed to be commemorated. And I'm not entirely sure if that was kind of in some ways heightened, or I guess clearly it must have been heightened by the HIV/AIDS crisis and this kind of need to commemorate and document people's lives that were here. And it's something that traditionally before that was not documented at all. So it's only because of people like Ross that we even have these things. Yeah, and it tells, you know, like I was saying before, it sounds like a pretty amazing story of the city and kind of an alternate view of the way people have always lived their lives here, because it's always been quite a vibrant queer city, kind of a collector city. And it's all down there.
I guess I'm curious as well about, you know, when people think of gay Montreal, I'm sure people have different things that come to mind, but at the basic level, you know, there's the history of the village. You know, for people who that's just basically all they know, all they think about, what are some of the things that they can learn about by going to an exhibition like this one?
I guess that it's not just relegated to one neighborhood in the city. And that, like, the idea of a quote-unquote village in Montreal actually has changed location. Like, in the 70s, it was down by Concordia University, and then it kind of made its way over to where it is now. that it's a very vibrant and activist-based scene as well, and that there's a lot of firsts in the city, and there's a lot of firsts in the show as well. Like, we have the first wedding certificate of two people of the same sex in Canada was recognized by a Supreme Court, so that's up on the wall as part of the exhibition. There's the first bar where people of the same sex could dance with one another called PJs. We have some objects from that. We have some photographs of some, you know, amazing trans people in the 1970s who lived and worked openly in Montreal. So it's quite a, I guess if your image of Montreal is, its queer scene is just the village, there's so much more. You know, and I think that this, the show really shows a lot of, and it's just a tip, you know, to avoid a cliche and saying it anyways, it's just like the tip of an iceberg, a big gay iceberg.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing to have these shows kind of bring new people into the archives and make them, yeah, more alive.
You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.
FM is proud to rebroadcast the following program entirely in the Mohawk language. The Mohawk, or Ganyatgahaga, are the original people of the unceded traditional territory known as Montreal, or Chojaake. The Ganyatgahaga, or people of the Flint, have two communities close by, and they are working hard at revitalizing their language. This program is part of those efforts, and it originally aired in Ganasadage on RKR Reviving Ganasadage Radio. And now, listen to Chojaake's indigenous language on CKUT.
Kwe ganasidak ke hrono, onegene giga ganto zaganas, idano injira zesa, nane izin.